As leaders of our families, we can either be inspiring or infuriating, according to our guest today. And I know we can be both on the same day within the same 5 minutes. Stay tuned. This is the Envoys Parenting Podcast, and we are your co-hosts, Jennifer L.W. Fink of buildingboys.net. And I'm Janet Allison of boysalive.com. Thanks for being here, for being our listeners, and supporting our sponsors.
As parents and teachers, we want and hope that our words have meaning. But reality says we won't always have the most brilliant thing to say. So do our words actually have the power to shape our children's future? Our guest today, a renowned social scientist, Columbia Business School professor, and father of two boys, 7 and 8, Adam Galinsky, has studied the profound impact of what he calls the parent amplification effect. He is the author of a brand new book called Inspire, The Universal Path for Leading Yourself and Others. You'll find this book quite applicable to your work life and definitely applicable to being the leader in your own home and if you're a teacher in school. Welcome, Adam.
Thank you so much. It's such a great pleasure to be here.
You know, even after that brief intro, I'm guessing some listeners are thinking, oh man, I hope my child doesn't remember what I said in that homework battle last night. And conversely, as I was reading your book, I was remembering, and I bet our listeners can remember too, some things that maybe their parents said to them when they were kids and that still resonate into adulthood, even though we wish they didn't. I've got a few. Jen, I'm guessing you might have one or two as well.
Mine were mostly unspoken things. And I think those might be stickier in some ways.
Well, because we add our own meaning into them too, don't we? Which I guess we do even with words that our parents say. So, you know, I think on one level, Adam, we know this is happening, but tell us why and how these comments have such impact.
Sure. Well, I'll start off by just saying the parent amplification effect is an extension of a term that I coined in the leadership world called the leader amplification effect. And the leader amplification effect basically says as leaders, we are essentially on stage, which means more attention is on us, and attention tends to amplify things and also increase the intensity or impact of our reactions to whatever we're observing. And so as leaders, because we're on stage, all of our actions, all of our reactions, so the nonverbal thing that Jen just mentioned, and also all of our interactions, so how we observe people interacting with others, get amplified and have intensified reactions within us. And so essentially, as parents, we are leaders of our family tribe. When our kids are very young, we're almost like gods to them, right? Deities, in a sense, that sort of wanes over time. But that means that we are the center of our child's universe. And during that period, they are paying very close attention to everything we say, everything we do, all of our expressions and all of our interactions. And because of that attention, the comments that we make and even the reactions that we have this incredible intensified reaction. And I think there's two things about this that I'll just add. One is, I think, you know, the homework battle you mentioned last night is going to have an impact today, and, you know, just as it had an impact last night. That said, the things that actually that we remember 20 years from now, 30 years from now, 40 years from now, those are going to be varied, and we might not even be able to predict which ones are going to matter tomorrow that matter today. But the thing that we know for certainty is that some of the things that we do when our parents are kids will stick with them forever.
Yeah. And you had a couple of examples in your book about kind of offhand comments, but that really shaped a child's life and future.
Yeah. And, you know, I first I was writing the book, and I have a doctoral student who's now a professor at Berkeley, Erica Bailey. And I can't even remember how the conversation came up, but she started talking about when she was, you know, probably around 12, she and her sister Abby were both piano players. And she overheard her mom say to someone else, "Oh, both girls are really great at piano, but Abby has a real knack for it." And that was so incendiary and incensing to Erica that she literally quit piano. Now, I assume this must have been just this incredible story that would have been told throughout the family history lore. And I met her mom at Erica's graduation. She was, you know, getting her doctorate. And I mentioned the story of the piano, and her mom was like, "Wait, what are you talking about?" I was like, "Do you not know why your daughter quit piano when she was 12? She's like, "No." And she's like, "Because of this offhand comment you made." So one of the most interesting things about the parent amplification effect is we might have this amplified effect on our kids and not even know that we had that effect, right? And so that's where this idea of these offhand comments can really matter. One story that I tell in the book that's not related to parents, but I really, really love it, is Barry Salzberg was president of Global Deloitte, the Deloitte consulting mm-hmm. company, you know, tens of thousands of employees. And he becomes CEO. And after about 6 months, he noticed that there are bananas at every executive meeting. And he starts thinking, you know, I've been at Deloitte for almost 30 years. Did I miss, are bananas some important symbol of Deloitte? Does someone really important love bananas? So he asked his assistant, "Why do we have bananas at every meeting?" And she said, "Because you love bananas." And he's like, "Wait, what?" Apparently, the first meeting they had, he picked up a banana with a little bit of enthusiasm. And his assistant, who was following everything he did, closely monitoring, coded that as, "I must have bananas at every meeting Barry's at." And so that's the same type of thing where we can see that, like, an offhand comment to our kids.
So this brings up lots of questions. Okay, so there is this impact, but we don't know which words they're going to latch on, and we are human. I try, Adam, but I am not always fully and completely in control of my reactions and my words in the way that I think we parents would like to be, because we are human as well. And I wonder that the comment about the piano, and she was age 12 at the time. 12, you are acutely sensitive to that kind of stuff. That similar comment, maybe when she was 6, wouldn't have had the same impact. But as a parent, I mean, what am I to do with this information as a parent? I am not going to say the right things all the time, especially because I don't know what they are and how my kids are going to take this at any given time.
Yeah, I think it's a really important point. Like, we're not perfect, right? We have missteps. And I think one of the most important things to do is what I might call, like, just monitoring and awareness, right? And so awareness is really the key feature of the parent amplification effect in two ways. One is being aware that as parents, we're going to have an impact. So be a little bit more careful with our words and sort of a little bit more thoughtful and strategic. And the second thing is
to add something to that. One thing that I learned as a parent, and for your information, my youngest is now 18. My oldest is 26, 27. And Janet, your kids are older yet, but I think we all eventually learn, as much as our kids are not necessarily listening to us when we're talking to them, they are listening all the time when we're not talking to them. So,
yeah, absolutely. Right. I think that's a great point. And I think that, so just being aware of that, right, that like an offhand comment to someone else, they might hear that and it might have a big impact. And then I think the second thing is that to be aware that to monitor our kids' behavior. So let me give you an example that has really struck me in my own life. So probably, I might even call it the greatest joy of my life, is my 8-year-old. From very young, he would wake up. He's an early riser. My 7-year-old, so, you know, he's a night owl who barely can get out of bed, you know, 5 minutes before school. But he would wake up, let's say 6:30, 6 o'clock, whatever it is, come into our bed and then snuggle about as tightly as you could imagine with me, and then fall back to sleep for about an hour. And I loved it more than anything. Like, his body was warm and how much she just set the intensity of his love. And then one day I noticed that he was coming to the bed, but like sleeping at the end of the bed and not getting near me. And so after like day two of this, I said, "Hey, Asher, why don't you want to snuggle with me?" And he said, "Because you don't want to snuggle with me." And I was like, "Wait, what?" And I was like, "That's not true. I love snuggling with you." He's like, "No, you don't." And no matter how many times I said that I do, it wouldn't deter him from saying, "No, you don't." And then about 6 hours later, I remembered. Two nights earlier, I'd been working on the book. It's probably went to bed at like 1 o'clock in the morning, much later than I normally do, maybe even two. And Asher came in earlier than normal, like 5 o'clock. And in this case, the snuggling was basically preventing me from going to sleep. And so I think I kind of abruptly got out of the bed and went to a couch and took a nap or tried to sleep for the rest of the night. And he took my departure from the bedroom as a, you know, utter and vigorous rejection of him and his snuggling. And so I went to him later and I just said to him, "Hey, Asher, I think what's going on is that the other night I got out of bed and I think you interpret that as somehow my not wanting to snuggle with you." And he kind of agreed that was the case. And I said, "You know, I'm really sorry that that happened. It was just a very particular circumstance where I was just really tired that night. And, you know, it wasn't, you know, at all an indictment of you or a rejection of your snuggling." And so by the next day, he was back to snuggling with me. And so I think that's a good example. Like, I should have acted better at time one, but I didn't. But the important thing was sort of monitoring and seeing the reaction. I'll give you one other very quick example. So Asher is a soccer player and he is, made the travel team at the age of six, which is, you know, kind of remarkable. And one time before he made the travel team, he scored like 4 goals in a game. And I said to him afterwards, you know, I said, "Oh, you know, I was impressed with the goals, but what really impressed me, were the 2 assists that you had." And then like for the next week, I noticed whenever Asher talked about soccer, he always said, "Oh, my dad's really impressed with my passing," or my dad liked my goals, but he really loved my assist. And then when he started doing travel soccer, I noticed that he almost never dribbled the ball. He would have passed it immediately. It was almost, you know, and so I realized that, you know, some of it's probably he wasn't the best player in the team. And so I think he was feeling a little uncomfortable, but also like this idea that passing mattered more. And so then I felt like I had to go back and say, "Hey, you know, like it's really important that you don't just pass the ball immediately, but like think about where to pass it to, or even think about dribbling so you're in a better position to pass later." And so that little comment, "I was really impressed with your assist," almost became this like overarching vision that was constraining him going forward.
This is so interesting. I'm a family coach, and so I actually encourage parents to use this amplification effect for good, and that is let your children overhear you talking to your partner or talking to grandma, and you can kind of amplify the qualities that you are trying to instill in your children. And I also talk about simply being an observer. And it's not like you never want to tell your children that, "Oh, I'm so impressed and I'm so in awe of you." But I think also if we can kind of be in that neutral observer position of just, "Oh, I noticed XYZ. And so it kind of keeps that opinion out of it so that, you know, hopefully they can see themselves clearly, but they aren't taking up unwittingly something that we said. And granted, like in the ideal world, and Adam, your brain, you're so in tune to noticing these in all places because that's what you live and breathe. And so for our listeners, you know, I think your examples kind of encourage us to go back and ask our children more deeply, "Hey, what's going on here?" So that we can just open up that understanding a little bit more.
Yeah. And I think probably as our kids get older, sometimes they can do it themselves. But sometimes even when they're younger, we need to set the framing for them. So Asher couldn't articulate that I had gotten out of bed and that had really upset him. But once I framed it that way, he acknowledged that was, you know, what was happening. And I think that we can help our kids sort of with that interpretation of their own experiences.
Mm-hmm. I think that one is such a good example too, because, you know, you mentioned earlier to our little kids, especially, I mean, we're kind of like gods, like food magically appears and all these things. Like they are so dependent on us that, evolutionarily, biologically, for their safety, like they are watching us very, very, very closely.
Yeah.
And our kids as children who are self-centered, because that's what they are at that point in life, they don't necessarily realize we have lives and impacts beyond them, right? So the fact that you might be tired because you were up late working on a book, that does not factor into your kids' thinking in any meaningful way. Or that, you know, something happened at work or with a situation with a friend. And it's good to think about this and to realize that as parents, one of the things that we can also do to be in relationship with our kids and help prepare them for the world at large is to let them in a little bit. I am really tired today. I didn't sleep well last night. I may be more short-tempered or whatever in developmental language.
Developmentally appropriately, it is good and it's allowed to let your children know that you might be struggling, that you didn't sleep well, as Jen says. And this helps our kids realize that parents, adults, are not perfect. And that's a good thing. More after these messages from our sponsors. Do you ever wonder what is going on under the surface for your son? Do you ever wish that you just had support, just had someone to talk to? You can. I have been a family coach for over 20 years. I have worked with countless parents to help get their family back on track to help you communicate in a boy-friendly way. You can schedule an absolutely free call with me at boysalive.com/call. Now, I encourage you to only take advantage of this offer if you are ready to make serious positive changes in your parenting and in your family. We'll talk for 30 minutes. If it feels like we're a good fit, I will tell you how we can work together privately. That's boysalive.com/call. You do not have to do this alone.
I just told you a little bit ago that my youngest son is 18, and I was talking to him a couple days ago, and I could tell he was confused. He was trying to interpret this look on my face. He's like, there's something wrong. Like, what's going on with you? And he's 18. I don't need to protect him as much as when he's, you know, 2 or 4. My mother is dealing with a health issue, and I had just learned about it. And I didn't plan on telling my boys until we knew more, but he saw it on my face, Adam. And in that instance, I think for me, I made the decision that it made more sense to let him know this thing that's bothering me, it has nothing to do with you directly.
Yeah. I mean, here's a good example of this. You know, Tuesday night was this surprising night. Around the election, you know, and one of the things that, you know, I had decided, you know, that I wasn't going to bring in, you know, the election to my kids because I think it was too much for them to process. But at a certain point, you know, I looked at my phone and I saw, you know, things weren't looking good in North Carolina. They weren't looking good in Georgia. You know, Pennsylvania hadn't started counting and I was getting pretty stressed. And my son, Asher, the older one, had a complete freak out because he got a new little notebook and he wanted to put his name and address. And we live at, you know, X number, Riverside Drive. And he wrote Riverside Drive and then the number. And then he just had a total meltdown that he had not put the number first. He realized he'd done it wrong. And it was just a complete meltdown. He was so upset. I tried to tell him, well, in a lot of countries, they actually put the number second. So everyone can figure out what it means. It's not going to be a problem. And I realized later, I think he had that freak out because I was feeling anxious and that anxiety was raising his anxiety. And then it got translated into perfectionism, you know, as a way to like get expressed. And I realized, you know, I didn't do as well when I was a, you know, earlier parent, but now that my kids are a little older and I've written this book and I think about this stuff and I teach leadership is I become really sensitive to that night of like, I'm not going to bring, you know, I'm not going to let this affect me and my kids. And of course, Tuesday night was one of the biggest events of the, you know, the year, right? So it was clearly going to have an impact on me and recognizing that. But again, I think one of the things is recognizing our own experiences and our kids' experiences allow us not to be so reactive in the moment. So I realized at one point he was freaking out and, you know, I needed to just think about it and how to help him without trying to, but recognizing that that it was triggered a little bit by my own experiences and how to remain, how important it was for me to remain calm in that moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I feel like now is a good point to emphasize and interject. Kids, humans are resilient.
Yes.
You are not going to damage your kid forever because of something that you said unintentionally. One thing is one thing. Yes, it may have an impact. But Adam, help us expand on that a little bit and provide some reassurance that, you know, you just used the term perfectionism in relationship to your son. But I think a lot of parents and leaders can take this to the extreme, too, and feel like I must do this perfectly at all times or else.
Yeah. You know, one of the things I've shown in my research is that there's a difference between shame and guilt. And guilt is actually a really constructive emotion because it reminds us what we did wrong and it helps us to essentially move forward in the future. So if you take the example with, you know, Asher, when I got out of bed, I felt guilty. And I said, okay, like that wasn't appropriate. I got to, like, next time if I'm tired, I either stay in bed or leave, you know, much more gently or, you know, think about that. Shame is actually pretty debilitating. Shame actually consumes us and it creates, you know, a combination of like avoidance and anxiety. And so I think that one of the things that I would say to parents is it's okay to feel guilt, but don't make yourself feel ashamed. Don't beat yourself up because beating yourself up is actually going to make you less present as a parent and it's going to make you avoidant and that's going to help you prepare less for the future to be a better parent. Now, in my research, I've shown this around financial decision-making, that people who feel shame about their finances make really poor financial decisions, partly because they go into either this avoidant or anxious mode, right? And that makes things worse. But the same thing I can be applied to being a parent, right?
I want to point out that we are recording this on the week of said election, which is what you were referring to on Tuesday night. And this episode will be coming out close to your book launch, which is in January, close to inauguration. So, and in your book, it's as you're talking about different kinds of leaders, which I found fascinating, you had a great comparison between Jimmy Carter and Donald Trump. And you talk about inspiring and infuriating leaders. And I do think that this is applicable to parenting as well. So kind of, you know, give us some guidelines around inspiring and infuriating leaders.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the parent amplification effect comes from the leader amplification effect. And I think that, so in my research, I've asked tens of thousands of people across the globe two very simple questions. Tell me about a leader that inspired you and tell me about a leader that infuriated you. And I've come to a number of, you know, very key insights. The first insight is that inspiring leaders and infuriating leaders, or you might call them inspiring parents and infuriating parents, right, are kind of mirror images of each other, right? Inspiring parent is generous, infuriating parent is selfish, right? An inspiring parent is courageous, and infuriating parent is cowardly, right? You can sort of see how that occurs. So they inspiring and infuriating exist on a continuum. The second thing is that that continuum is sort of made up of three universal factors. And there's two key words there, three and universal. And it's universal in the sense that there's not a single attribute about inspiring and infuriating leaders that doesn't exist in every single country in the world. It's the same thing. It's really, I think, embedded in the human brain and in the architecture of our mind. And the three factors are really about how we see the world, how we are in the world, and how we interact in the world. And I call them visionary, exemplar, and mentor. And the reason why they're the three universal factors, and I think the reason why they're so important to understand leadership, but also to understand what it means to be a parent, is because each of those satisfy four fundamental human needs. So being visionary satisfies our need for meaning and purpose. And I'll come back to that in 1 second. Being exemplar satisfies our the fundamental human need for protection and energy and passion. And then the being a mentor satisfies the fundamental human need of a sense of belonging and a sense of feeling like one is respected, has status, right? And the meaning purpose one, I think, is particularly interesting from, you know, a parent perspective, is that, you know, research shows us very clearly, right, that when you become a new parent, your life gets worse, right? You sleep, you rarely sleep, you barely shower, you never have sex, right, or almost never. And your house is a mess, your body is a mess, your mind is a mess. And so one of the things that, you know, evolutionary psychologists wondered is, why has our species not died out?
Right? Why do we do this?
Yeah. But of course, if you ask a new parent, you know, about the experience, they'll talk about all the travesties of daily living. But all of them will talk about their life has profound sense of meaning. You know, my twin brother described it as a love fiercer than he ever thought possible, right? Or had ever experienced before. And so one of the most interesting things about the idea of inspiring being embedded sort of in the architecture of the human mind actually comes from parenting. We are biologically conditioned to crave a sense of meaning and purpose. Now, we probably are biologically conditioned because of parenthood. Now, you don't have to be a parent to crave meaning and purpose. It's driven because we want to extend our species, and we do that through parenthood. But it's embedded in the very architecture of the human mind, regardless. And so I think that's also one of the roots of the parent amplification effect, is our kids are always searching for meaning and purpose in our behavior.
Yeah.
As you were talking, I was thinking about so many families that I talk to when they're talking about, you know, how they were raised and their parents. Is I feel like my dad was the infuriating leader of my family, and my mom was the inspiring leader of my family.
Yeah, you know, I think for me, you know, I think that one of the core tenets of this book is that we are not born as inspiring leaders or infuriating leaders or aspiring parents, is that it's really our current behavior inspires or infuriates. And so there's a profound implication, which is that each and every one of us can be a more inspiring leader and a more inspiring parent, right? Because there is a defined scientific set of characteristics that make up the inspiring person. We can learn those, we can nurture those, we can develop those, right? And I think that's one of those important things. I think another thing that comes up, and I mentioned this around Jimmy Carter and Donald Trump, is that many of us are inspiring on some dimensions and infuriating on other dimensions, right? And I think when we think about our parents, you know, one of the things I say in the book is that, you know, one of the great epiphanies of my life, you know, is when I realized my parents weren't perfect. Right. You know, we're gods, we're deities at one point. And then all of a sudden, over time, we learn their infuriating flaws, you know. And so for me, you know, my parents were both, you know, probably my dad was the more inspiring and my mom was a little bit more infuriating. But they each had their moments or their elements, right, in which they were uniquely capable of really supporting us. You know, my dad was, you know, creative, big picture thinking, who just made us feel, you know, protected and safe. And he was great to go on walks with and talk about life, but he didn't always have like the nurturing touch, you know. And so, like,
the many real differences between many, many moms and many, many dads. And that's okay. More after these messages from our sponsors.
Do you have your copy of Building Boys yet? This is my second book, you guys. Building Boys, Raising Great Guys in a World That Misunderstands Males. If you listen to this podcast, I know you will love this book. Please order it. You can find it on Amazon. You can find it at your independent booksellers. Building Boys, Raising Great Guys in a World That Misunderstands Males. If you already have a copy, thank you so much. Please consider leaving a review. That will help sell more books and get the word out. Thanks.
One example is my mom would send us, you know, letters when we were at camp, you know, and my dad wasn't really big on that. You know, my mom would leave notes in the morning, like little things. She'd remember people's birthdays in her orbit and get them that special gift that really touched their heart, you know. Whereas my dad probably didn't know who anyone's birthday was, you know, you know, barely our own as kids, you know. So I think that there's ways that we can think about also about being partners as parents to satisfy our kids' needs. And I think that's a really important thing. And I think that, you know, I'll just say one thing, you know, COVID was tough on lots of parents and it was tough on my wife and I. And I think we had some of our lowest moments as a married couple during COVID, you know, and struggling to do that. And I think that one of the things that ended up impairing us was we were feeling overwhelmed and then wanting the other one to protect us and then feeling frustrated when we weren't. And it was this sort of mutual reinforcing state. But I think the one thing that really is important as parent is to celebrate the other parent's inspiring attributes in front of the kids. And I think that's exactly what you know, we were saying about letting them listen. And so highlighting, you know, there's times when the boys lean, you know, more towards me because they love sports and I play with them and I'm a fast reader because that's what I do for a living, you know, but like reminding them of all the amazing things their mom does, I think is really important because sometimes it can start steering, you know, in one direction versus the other.
I have a question. Inspiring leadership, infuriating leadership on a continuum, you said. Yep. My personal bias definitions, interpretations, broadly, I tend to think of inspiring as a better thing than infuriating. But I do wonder, are there times when inspiring leadership is like a more appropriate fit? And times when infuriating leadership may be a more appropriate fit?
Yeah, I mean, I think what you might say is, what do we find inspiring and what do we find infuriating depends on the context.
Okay.
And so I think as, you know, one example, like I think Donald Trump as a candidate, I think is very inspiring. You know, I think he was more infuriating as a president. And I think that's one reason why he's won two elections when he wasn't president, right? When he was simply a candidate.
Interesting.
And I think so some of that, you know, bombastic claims, you know, become resonating when you're not the person who's actually in charge, you know? And so I think the same thing is true. You know, here's a good example. You know, coaches, parents, leaders, right? They're all part of the same fabric, right? And, you know, one of the questions, I was interviewing the coach, the former coach of Columbia. He took a team that hadn't won a game in 2 years. And within 2 years, had turned them around into a winning record, you know? And I was talking to him about all the things he did. But he said one thing that I thought was the most important thing, which is maybe the single hardest thing he has to decide every single season is this. Who can he yell at? He said, who can I yell at? Now, if I yell at the wrong person and that person crumbles, the whole team could turn against me. But if I yell at the right person and they alter their behavior in the direction I want them to go, then it changes the very fabric.
Mm.
And you know, this happened the other night. I'm a huge Golden State Warriors fan because I love Steph Curry. And Steph Curry did something that he's known for doing is throwing a very creative, ill-advised pass that led to a turnover and Boston quickly scored on the other end. And Steve Kerr, the coach of the Warriors, called an immediate timeout and just lit into Curry on the court, just screaming at him. And of course, you know, they went on to win this game against Boston and Boston's home court. It was this incredible victory. And, you know, reporters, of course, noticed this. And they said, you know, tell us what was happening, you know, when you yelled at him. He's like, look, when we were superior in talent, we could do 20 turnovers and still win by 20. We can't do that anymore. Like, every possession matters. And so I needed him to know that he can't play like he did in the past, right? We don't have the same margin of error. Like, we're going to win on the margins, the small things. And that's what makes Steph great, is that, you know, he didn't, you know, grumble, and he understood that he can't play that way. And, you know, they asked him about it afterwards, and he said, yeah, I didn't sulk. You know, I went back and I, you know, got back in the game and took better care of the ball. And so, like, but then when people see, you know, who's the leader there? Well, Steve Kerr is the coach. Steve Curry is the leader. And then when you see this person respond in that way, it tells you we all have to respond in that way. And so that's kind of what the coach was saying. And I think the same thing is, you know, as a parent, you know, can I yell at the middle child and then the older child will respond because the middle child's more resilient, you know, or is the older child the one that's going to be more resilient? And so you kind of got to figure out, like, what you have to do in order to do that. And I think that, you know, I'll give you just one last quick example of this. So this is true of firstborns. If anyone who studied firstborns, later borns, the firstborn is on average far more conscientious, you know, diligent, you know, focused on perfectionism, you know, things like that. And, you know, Asher in first grade, you know, he was just would always do his homework right away. And, like, he would go above and beyond. And Aiden had one homework assignment a week as a kindergartner, and he resisted it. You know, it was always tooth and nail getting him to do. He just had to write three words that started with a certain letter. You could do up to like 16, and, you know, Asher would do all 16. Aiden would do three. Maybe he'd get to six, you know, and stuff like that. So I was really worried this year, like, how he's going to handle first grade. But I didn't tell him that. I didn't say I'm worried about this. You know, I was observing. But, you know, he's really risen to the challenge, and he's become totally motivated, and he wants to do his homework at night. And I think just seeing his older brother do it, you know, and seeing the way that we interacted with his older brother helped him get that. And I think that's one of the things I try to tell my wife over and over again, is that she gets nervous. She sees a behavior and she's so worried that it's going to become permanent.
Mm-hmm. Janet, how many times have we said that about moms, especially? We are great at that, Adam. Yes. Like, I know he's six, but do you know what this is going to mean when he's 26?
Right. He didn't make it bed today. Oh my God, he's never going to get a job.
Yes.
You know, but, you know, as one example, I just have this really, really strong belief that we develop independence through nurturance. And so, for example, last year, Asher had to write three sentences a week in first grade, and he really wanted my help with them. And it was really upsetting to my wife, because she's like, you're supposed to do them alone. And I said, well, you know, we'll do it collaboratively. I said, I'm going to do it for a few weeks. And then after a few weeks, I said, okay, Asher, it's really important that you do one of the sentences all by yourself, you know. And then slowly over time, you know, we got to the point where now he doesn't ask for my help at all with the sentences. And so just recognizing that, like, what does it mean to be independent? We can lead. Like, if someone's asking that, my Asher said, I need your help, I can't do this. So how do I help them in a step-by-step process towards the end goal? Whereas I think sometimes, you know, we can get too focused on, oh my God, he's supposed to be doing this independently, I can't help him. But how can I help him today so he can do it independently tomorrow?
Yeah. It's like in a past podcast, Jen and I were talking about my grandson, his 2.5, Beau. And, you know, he discovered the slide just a few weeks ago, and he wanted my help getting down the slide for the first three times. And now he doesn't need my help. So, you know, just it's what you're saying, just that stair step scaffolding. But you have given us a wider perspective, who have helped us to see that, yes, we do have an impact and an influence on our children. We can also use that for good, and sharing, you know, in front of our other family members. And I think it's about focusing on the qualities. It's not the exact, you know, whether you wrote that sentence by yourself or not, but it's the larger qualities that we're trying to enhance and engage with for our children. And so you've really given us some food for thought here, Adam. Your book is Inspire, the Universal Path for Leading Yourself and Others. And, you know, applicable for leadership, applicable for parenting. It has so many great examples, but also how-tos. So I encourage our listeners to check out this book. Adam, thank you so much for your time and your wisdom.
Thanks so much for having me.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode. This is the On Boys Parenting Podcast. We're your co-hosts, Janet Allison of BoysAlive.com and Jennifer L.W. Fink of BuildingBoys.net. Thanks for being our listeners and for touching in with our sponsors occasionally.